The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
Hey folks, this is The Takeaway for Tuesday, August 30th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And would you resign if you said this in a moment of inflated passion about the drug problem in your state?
When you go to war, if you know the enemy dresses in red and you dress in blue, you shoot at red. You try to identify the enemy. And the enemy right now, the overwhelming majority of people coming in are people of color or people of Hispanic origin.
That's only one of the reasons the governor of Maine, Paul LePage, heard there, his career is filled with question marks today. LePage has apologized for his comments. He's apologized for his behavior and for leaving a profanity-laced voicemail for Democratic Representative Drew Gattin, who LePage was mistakenly told called him a racist. He told reporters that he would like to challenge Gattin to a duel and shoot him right between the eyes. LePage made clear he was sorry for saying those things to Representative Gattin and confirmed what others he's been meeting with have been saying all day, that LePage is considering resigning, which would leave the Republican Senate president in charge. Maine is a state that has voted Democratic in every presidential election since 1992, but Paul LePage won two statewide elections as a Republican. Cynthia Dill, a lawyer, columnist, and former Democratic state senator from Maine, joins us to answer some of our questions. Thanks for joining us, Cynthia.
Thank you for having me, John.
What is the LePage factor in determining where Maine stands in the November election?
Well, I think Governor LePage is going to do a lot to move the needle in the election, both at the presidential level as well as local races in Maine. Our entire legislature, like many states, turns over every 2 years. And so I think people will be running primarily, whether they're with LePage or against him, similar to the referendum on Trump.
So is that to say that LePage is popular and Mainers go, hey, all the rest of you down continental U.S. know-nothings, leave us alone. We love our LePage.
I don't think he's popular. I do think, though, that if you're a Republican running for the state legislature, you have to be clear with your constituents whether you are going to Augusta to support Governor LePage or to work essentially against him, because every piece of legislation now, because of LePage's veto, you know, in addition to him being a racist and a homophobe and threatening to shoot people, he also has a record of vetoes every piece of legislation that might move the state forward. So people who are running for the state legislature have to be clear with their constituents whether they're going to be a supporter of LePage or going to work with the group of Republicans who are, you know, trying to collaborate with Democrats and address some of our problems here. We have a significant drug crisis. We have 20% of our children are living in poverty. It's difficult to find a job. There's wage stagnation. There's serious issues that Maine people want government to address. And unfortunately, there's a huge distraction every week by our governor.
Any benefit of the doubt, wiggle room here? I mean, is he possibly just not a racist and doesn't really want to shoot people of color? Just has a little problem with candor and has been misquoted or anything like that? Is just a sort of colorful character that we don't quite understand down here in New York and points south?
Yes. I mean, if you're in a room with Paul LePage, he's a charming, charismatic person. I don't have any personal animus towards him. I share some laughs with him. Unfortunately, though, he conflates being politically correct with exercising any judgment whatsoever with what comes out of his mouth. He doesn't seem to have any self-control when it comes to just blurting out things. You know, he doesn't have an awareness of what the consequences are to his words, and that's a real problem.
Well, this is a week of exploring the lack of self-control of all kinds of people, that's for sure. Is LePage a friend of Donald Trump?
I don't know that personally. He's certainly an image of Donald Trump. He's a variation of Donald Trump. And Maine has that electorate that tends to gravitate towards these candidates. We have a rural state. We have white state, 95% white, a lot of uneducated people who are down and out because of the loss of manufacturing jobs. And so there is an element to our constituency that appeals to this kind of demagogue that's promising to go back to the time when things were good for uneducated white guys.
Yet there are, moderate senators in Washington from Maine who have expressed a certain amount of outrage and worry about Donald Trump. Cynthia Dill, this is a very interesting state and very interesting politics for November. Former Maine state senator, lawyer, and columnist, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
From Maine to Florida, there is a primary today. Marco Rubio is trying to hold on to his Senate seat. Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz is facing a tough primary challenge. Former Governor Charlie Crist is hoping to restart his political career in the House of Representatives. And will the results of Florida's primary tell us anything about the Trump-Clinton race in November? Craig Pittman is a reporter with the Tampa Bay Times and author of Oh, Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country. Craig, that's entertaining. Welcome.
Thank you.
So what is it about this primary that's going to give us some indication of where Florida stands in the race in November?
Well, we've got a number of congressional seats open, including a pretty interesting and classically odd U.S. Senate race involving, among other things, a candidate who boasts that he sacrificed a goat and drank its blood. And that should give us some indication how this turns out. It should give us some indication of which party might wind up controlling Congress under the new administration.
What about the presidential race? I noticed that drinking the blood of a goat is actually something that Donald Trump has not done so far.
Not yet. But, you know, there's still time before the debates. The amount of turnout will be key, I think. And also, everyone is always watching what happens in the Interstate 4 corridor, the I-4 corridor, because that's supposed to be the Sunbelt version of Dixville Notch, that we look to that to see who's going to win Florida and thus, you know, who wins the election.
So South Florida is in the blue column and Tallahassee and the Panhandle remain in the red column, even despite the controversy over Donald Trump. And where does that put Orlando in the center?
That's what we don't know. That's the swingingest part of the swingingest swing state, because we've got such an interesting mix of folks there. We've got huge influx of Puerto Ricans in that area. We've got a very large gay community there. It was interesting in looking at the history of the area that it was a very, very conservative area until the theme parks opened and they brought in all their employees are union members, so, and they tend to vote Democratic. So that area switches back and forth, so we'll obviously be watching them to see which way they go. But that's the reason why you see Orlando is currently the market that's seeing the most spending on presidential campaign ads right now.
And how's Marco Rubio doing?
For a guy who's running for a seat he said he didn't really want, he seems to be doing okay. Once again, it's a sort of a classic Florida irony. He's running for a seat he didn't really want to have anymore, and he's being opposed by a developer named Carlos Baruff, who styles himself as a sort of a mini Trump, and yet Trump has endorsed Rubio, even though the two guys clearly don't like each other, instead of endorsing the guy who's styling himself on Trump.
What about the most controversial member of the Democratic National Committee, the former chair? What's her fate going to be? She seems to be in a safe congressional district, but that doesn't mean her race is going to be quiet.
Well, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, or as I like to call her, Florida woman, she looked to be in trouble there for a while because Bernie Sanders was very strongly backing her opponent, Tim Canova. But once the Sanders campaign kind of fell apart, then so did his support for Canova, and that's sort of dried up now. I think Wasserman Schultz seems to be pretty safe as far as her reelection chances.
Will the weather cooperate?
Probably not. It never does. We're kind of keeping an eye on a tropical storm today as people are going to the polls. Although that certainly did help spur, I think, some of the people who were interested in doing early voting. We had about 1.7 million folks who did early voting this time.
Craig Pittman is a reporter with the Tampa Bay Times and author of Oh, Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country. Thanks so much, Craig.
Thank you.
What are you doing?
I'm getting bad. You're bad. They don't mess with you.
That's right. We're bad, huh?
Darn right.
Gene Wilder, whose death we learned about yesterday, was the kind of bad that's good. the kind of actor you have to see to understand. His gentle face contrasted with the terrified comedic hysteria of Richard Pryor in Stir Crazy and See No Evil, Hear No Evil, and others. Wilder and Pryor's was the kind of collaboration that made Wilder's career one of a kind, paired two at a time with the best, and he made them all better. The macho gunslinger in Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles.
I don't know if you ever heard of me before, but I used to be called the Waco Kid.
He had the fastest hands in the West.
In the world.
Again with Mel Brooks and actor Marty Feldman in the classic Young Frankenstein, or Frankenstein.
Are you saying that I put an abnormal brain into a 7.5-foot-long gorilla?
Gene Wilder is perhaps best known and remembered for his role in the creepy but wonderful Roald Dahl classic Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
But what's it do?
Can't you see? It makes everlasting gobstoppers.
How do you make them?
I'm a trifle deaf in this ear. Speak a little louder next time.
Wilder was as famous and successful as any actor in Hollywood. His marriage to comedian Gilda Radner and her death from cancer and their very public approach to talking about it changed forever the way we look at the disease. Wilder was tailor-made, I guess, to be a bit bent in his thinking about everything.
But under the right circumstances, a producer could make more money with a flop than he could with a hit.
In Mel Brooks' original cult movie, The Producers, about a Hitler musical, it was Gene Wilder who made Zero Mostel better and set the tone for a career of upbeat, positive, rip-roaring comedy.
I want everything I've ever seen in the movies!
Leo, say you'll join me!
I'll do it!
Comedy that came from a very special place that he talked about in a memory shortly before Alzheimer's claimed his memory forever.
After having worked in a neuropsychiatric hospital when I was in the Army, I said, I'm not so different from these boys, except that they're crazy and I'm not, but I think sometimes I'm on the borderline, and that gave me the courage to seek help.
Gene Wilder, the man from Milwaukee, humble, brilliant, his gift of a long life, 83 years, our gift.
There is no life I know to compare with pure imagination. Living there, you'll be free if you truly wish to be.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
On August 14th, chaos at JFK Airport. What wasn't real, though, was the threat. There were no gunmen. There was no shooting that night at JFK. Instead, there was most likely a loud noise from an airport bar celebrating Usain Bolt's victory in the 100-meter dash. And we've got something of the same sort of story at LAX, the West Coast airport in Los Angeles, this past Sunday night.
Ground, this is United 488. Apparently there's an active shooting in the terminal. Can you please advise us what's happening?
Yeah, we can confirm that there's people running in the streets here.
Confirm what? Well, there certainly were people running in the streets. Stampedes, people running onto the tarmac, major delays because a false report of an active shooter caused, again, most likely by a loud noise, according to the Los Angeles Police Department, a noise that had nothing to do with shooting at all. Terrence Young is hoping to design airports that put a stop to these kinds of events. He's an aviation and transportation design director at Gensler and is currently designing a new concourse at LAX and San Francisco, among others. Terrence, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So, Terrence, what are the particular problems in quick movement of people in situations like this? Since 9/11, all of the design of airports has gone into the supposedly efficient movement of people through security lines onto airport concourses and then onto their flights and onto their journeys. But in these kinds of situations, it seems like all of that is working against safe, you know, movement of people.
That's an interesting perspective. It's true that since 9/11, the airport design has radically shifted. The checkpoint design in particular is something that has been something that is in evolution, and even so much as the projects that were done 5 years ago and the projects that I'm doing today, the checkpoint design is constantly evolving because the designs are trying to keep a step ahead of what we call current threat levels, right? And as the threats change, the design is trying to adapt to them as quickly as possible to do all things. And as you say, the situations at JFK and LAX were really an issue of getting information to the people and getting information out to the authorities so that they could handle the circulation, handle the people, tell them where to go. And when I think of the both of those situations, I think that the training of the people conspires to work with the design of the building in order to move people in the right direction and give them the information that they need.
Are panic incidents at an airport incompatible with the bottleneck nature of the checkpoint design as you describe it?
I wouldn't say it's incompatible. The checkpoint design is evolving, and what we're trying to do, what we try to do, is create a checkpoint that works with the guidelines that the security people bring to us. And our job, the architects and the planning of the design, is really trying to do two things. It's trying to make the design efficient for 99.9% of the time when people are traveling, which is to say to keep people safe, to keep people secure, to get them more efficiently moving from the land side, the non-secure side, to the air side. And that is something that is evolving. We're designing checkpoints now that are, like I said, that are different than 5 years ago, even. And
well, we could really talk for an hour about this, because it seems to me a shooting incident or a panic incident on one side of the security line is a completely different incident than one that takes place on the other side of the security line.
Sure. Well, I think the checkpoint is meant to keep any kind of incident happening on the other side of the line. The land side of the line is to keep weapons, to keep any kind of bomb or any kind of device from getting onto the air side, and it's very efficient at that. So,
but in the JFK case, there was no bomb. There was just a sound coming from, I presume, a bar that was on the other side of the checkpoints.
Right.
And so you have to assume that there was a weapon that made it through the checkpoints.
Well, that's the assumption. And of course, what happened was there was a loud noise because there was a bar celebrating. And so people's reactions are really what can't be designed into it. The thing that helps people feel secure and comfortable is information, right? So I'm going to go back to the way we design airports these days is to create as much clarity as possible so that people feel comfortable. As we found that a safe airport, an airport that is designed to bring comfort, we are using hospitality, we're using visibility. Like in San Francisco, if you're coming through the checkpoint, you can see beyond the checkpoint. It's not a labyrinth. You're entering into a space where you can comfortably put on your shoes and wait for somebody else. The idea is to give as much comfort and, frankly, delight and information to a traveler so that when someone is looking nervous, when somebody is acting suspicious, they stand out more in a crowd of people that are actually comfortable. So the design consideration from an architectural standpoint, designing a building that allows travelers to be more relaxed and comfortable, then threats are more easily identified.
Terrence Young is an aviation and transportation design director at the firm Gensler. He spoke to us from NPR West in Los Angeles. Terrence, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Brazil's suspended President Dilma Rousseff went before the Senate on Monday and maintained her innocence in a country that has accused her of moving funds between government budgets with the skill of an Olympic gymnast to hide Brazil's deficit. Rousseff also called the trial illegitimate.
I'm absolutely sure in relation to my acts as the President of the Republic, and I am personally here before those who are judging me. I am going to look in your eyes, and I will say with the serenity of someone who has nothing to hide that I haven't committed any crimes against budget responsibility.
The Senate is expected to vote this week on whether to permanently remove Rousseff from office. Two-thirds of the Senate must find her guilty. If it's a less than two-thirds vote, though, she will be reinstated. Alex Quadros is a reporter and author of Brazilianaires, Wealth, Power, Decadence, and Hope in an American Country. He returned from Rio de Janeiro in July, and he joins me now in the studio. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I watch the Olympics. I watch what goes on in Brazil. I mean, people are riveted to their televisions on this political controversy. And the tone of lawmakers even gives it a sense of history in the making. There's a certain gravitas. But there's also a sense in Brazil that this is just a bunch of jokers here going through the motions of something that we have no faith in. How can both of those be kind of true?
Well, I think it's important to understand, first of all, that Brazil has only been a democracy for three decades. In the mid-80s, it emerged from a two-decade military dictatorship. So the institutions are maturing. It's as stable as I think it's ever been as a democracy. But it's not, a country like the United States with more than 200 years of consolidated democracy. And during several parts of the impeachment process, I think there have been legitimate questions about whether due process is being followed. When it was the lower house of Congress's turn to decide on the president's impeachment, it really was a circus-like atmosphere with congressmen citing God and their families and the fight against communism, which I think everyone had thought had been decided sometime in the past as their reasons for impeachment. The proceedings right now in the Senate have been a bit more sober. They seem to be seriously focused on the technical questions at hand, which is whether she violated budget rules.
Does the sense of the Olympics having transpired without some obvious global fiasco, American swimmers notwithstanding, does that give more confidence to either the people of Brazil, the lawmakers of Brazil, the institutions of Brazil in this moment?
Well, it's interesting that Dilma's impeachment is happening right now, right after the Olympics have ended. And this is intentional. The impeachment calendar purposely took account of the Olympics because it would have just been too surreal and embarrassing for the country to be impeaching its president while the whole world is watching and the Olympics are going on. You know, I think the fact that the Olympics went off without much of a hitch, at least in terms of organization or violence when it comes to tourists and athletes, I think that gives the impression that the event was a success. But I also think that it pushes into the background the really serious questions about how much this event cost to the country and to the city. And the fact is that Rio is now on the verge of bankruptcy.
Well, that's the question. Is this a powder keg in Rio? Is the pressure building nationally? And, you know, if we were talking 5 years ago, Brazil could do no wrong. It was the fastest growing economy in the developing world by far. Has it squandered that growth in a mass of Petrobras oil corruption and political misbehavior that we're seeing right now?
Well, it really is amazing the contrast between the Brazil that was in the headlines, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago and the Brazil that we see today. I arrived in the country in 2010, and this euphoria about the country's economic prospects was palpable not only in the foreign headlines, but really inside the country. People were optimistic about the future in a way that I don't think that they ever had been before, at least on that scale, because, you know, it's a country that has been through lots of booms and busts, but this is the first boom that the poor also shared in the gains. And more than 30 million people were lifted from extreme poverty, in part because of the economic growth, in part because of welfare programs. And, you know, I think what's important to realize now is that by the same token that the optimism and the euphoria was probably over the top back in 2010 or so, I think the pessimism may be overdone now. And people are acting like, you know, it's going to be the next Venezuela or something.
And but that's incorrect.
This is absolutely incorrect. It's a country of 200 million people with a diverse economy. The institutions don't always function in a very pretty way, but they do essentially function.
Alex Quadros is a reporter and author of Brazilianaires, Wealth, Power, Decadence, and Hope in an American Country. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you were a middle school student or just even a teenager in the last 20 years, your sex ed class may have had a little help from one of these little creatures. That's a RealityWorks brand baby crying, a robot tryout baby, a stroke of genius from a former NASA engineer who perhaps came up with crash test dummies as well. But he decided that less realistic sack of flour babies weren't a good substitute for the real thing to teach young people. So he developed a baby doll with a cry, you heard it there, to be turned off by a teenage caregiver to give students an idea of how difficult, how much work it is to be a parent and therefore possibly prevent teen pregnancy. But a study recently published in The Lancet showed the opposite. The study followed thousands of teenage girls in Western Australia, and it turned out the girls who took care of the robot baby were more likely to get pregnant before they turned 20. The study's author said the difference was small, but Nicole Cushman is the executive director of ANSWER, a program at Rutgers University that advocates comprehensive sex education. In the U.S., where standards for what constitutes sex education vary widely, she was not surprised by the news that robo-babies may not be as effective elsewhere at reducing teen pregnancy.
In reality, most young people who do experience a pregnancy, it's unintended. What we know about the research on comprehensive sex education is that when we address the full range of options available to young people, we talk to them about abstinence, we talk to them about how to figure out when is the right time for them to become sexually active, but we also talk to them about a full range of contraceptive methods and condoms, we are able to help young people delay the first time they have sex. And there has not been any persuasive evidence to date that using simulators is effective. So this latest study to come out of Australia is just the latest in a series of such evaluations that have all concluded, while you might get some changes in terms of young people's attitudes towards pregnancy and childbearing, no actual behavioral changes.
Did the numbers actually in some cases show the opposite effect that it encourages?
From this latest study, it certainly appears so. I haven't seen that in prior research, so I don't know if that will be borne out and if we could say consistently that it has a detrimental effect.
Although as a parent on some level, you would think, duh, you know, babies are adorable. They're a lot of work, but something about being around babies does bond you with the idea of being a parent.
That's absolutely true. And there have been prior approaches that involved bringing young parents into classrooms to talk about their experience with parenting and with a heavy emphasis on the hardships. But some of those programs have also shown detrimental effects, because if these young parents bring their children into the classroom with them, inevitably you have people kind of oohing and aahing over these adorable babies, and it can have an opposite effect. At the same time, we also don't want to stigmatize young parents, many of whom are doing a tremendous job with raising their families in very difficult circumstances often.
So in a situation where an individual who is predisposed to becoming a parent, a mother, as a teenager, if they acquire the information from a comprehensive sex education program that makes them a better parent, a healthier spouse, you would not consider that necessarily a failure if the individual becomes pregnant and yet they go on to have a successful family.
Ultimately, what I would consider a success in any sex education program is that young people are equipped with the knowledge and the skills that they need to make the decisions that are going to be best for them and their futures. So that may include pregnancy. We do know that getting pregnant and having a child at a young age can be a tough road for a lot of young people. But we also can't ignore the other drivers of teen pregnancy, many of which are related to poverty and income inequality and really complex circumstances that many young people grow up in. So sex education is one piece of the puzzle, but it's not the key to delaying parenthood.
You remind me of a book that came out in the 90s that was based on a series of reports from a Washington Post reporter by the name of Leon Dash, who now is a professor. What his work showed, what his reporting showed, was that women became mothers because the economic circumstances offered that as the only means for them to have what appeared to them to be a meaningful option in life. And what Dash also discovered was that that was the case regardless of whether they were black or white, which was at the time when everyone assumed that teen pregnancy was something that had to do with African Americans.
Right, right. It's important to note that the teen pregnancy rate today is at an all-time low, and we have seen declines among all racial and ethnic groups, and including steeper declines among African American girls, but they still remain disproportionately impacted. And a lot of that is inextricably linked with poverty. And you're absolutely right. That same research holds true today. Until young people have viable options for economic opportunities, for educational opportunities, they don't necessarily have the motivation to delay parenthood. They also won't necessarily wind up in worse circumstances for having become parents. So when we look at research done with siblings, for example, that grew up in very similar or identical circumstances, but one becomes pregnant and one does not, their economic outcomes and their educational outcomes are quite similar. So I think it forces us to rethink these goals around teen pregnancy prevention and really put them in a broader context of what's going on in young people's lives.
That's a really fascinating statistic. What do you think is the reason for the decline in teen pregnancy? And that's something that we should celebrate, but that doesn't necessarily mean that sex education, which can be a real hodgepodge of the kinds of things that people learn about, depending on where you are in the country, is the reason for all of that.
You're absolutely right. So this is, again, a multifaceted, complex issue. Sex education has likely played some role. Better access to contraception, though, is probably the biggest driver. So when we look at young people's rates of sexual activity and we look at their rates of use of condoms and contraception, we see that it's really in terms of contraceptive use and condom use that we've made the greatest strides. So young people are very capable of making responsible decisions in terms of using condoms and contraception when they're equipped with the information and they have access to those services. it's, again, a really complex story. So that's only one piece of the puzzle.
Nicole Cushman is executive director of ANSWER, a program at Rutgers University that advocates comprehensive sex ed. It helps schools implement these kinds of programs. Nicole, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Zach from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Kids are sexualized so early these days that I think talking to them about respect and love, not in the romantic sense, but in terms of the love of the other, needs to be added to curriculum. Kids will always have sex with each other. It's natural. How they engage in the new, exciting art of love is something that we adults can help develop in our culture.
Kathy from Salem, Oregon. I went to Catholic school where sex ed meant that the girls were taken to the library and shown glass jars of babies who were aborted. I learned never to use birth control, but yet I still had sex and always knew that if I got pregnant, I would still have an abortion. I knew minimal about my reproductive self until I was pregnant at the age 32.
Now that is mind-blowing. Zach's experience there in Minnesota, I wonder how many kids Zach has. And Kathy in Salem, Oregon, couldn't be more different. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.